Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 335. Thursday, September 5th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, Sea Realm Vault subscribers, KMO here. And the first thing that I want to share with you is the audio from a video call that I recorded with Doug Lane. Maybe you know, maybe you don't. Some of you watch my YouTube videos, others not. But I've been doing, for 2019, my resolution was to upload something to YouTube every day. And just over a month ago, I put Andrew Yang's name in the title of a video and got about 10 times as many views as I normally would, or so I thought. Today's YouTube video is called The Big Number is a Lie. And when more people than usual come in, they don't come in with any appreciation of, you know, the general context of my videos. And so, you know, the video that got all these views was a 13-minute video, almost 14 minutes, actually. And the average view time was just over 4 minutes. And I can tell, I mean, if you go to YouTube and you're watching videos, Google knows how old you are. And they report that information, you know, among many other things, to the creators of the videos whose content you're watching. So I know that, for the most part, people who watch my videos on YouTube are Gen X. But I also know, looking at the analytics for my videos, that when I get a big bump and a lot more people than usual come in, they're mostly millennials. And they don't watch the whole video. So that's why today's video is called The Big Number is a Lie. You know, the big number is the total number of views. But most of the people represented in that big number didn't actually watch the whole video. And if they did, they were just, you know, as soon as they realized I wasn't a straightforward, hooray, Andrew Yang, you know, uncritical, just total supporter for him, they turn ugly. So today I announced that I'm abandoning this, you know, Andrew Yang themed video a day project. And just going back to talking about whatever I want to talk about. But during the month when I was doing an Andrew Yang themed video every single day, I had some regular CROM guests on, on video calls to talk about Andrew Yang. And some of these you've heard, like the James Howard Kunstler interview. You know, most of it was just for the podcast, but the first 10 minutes or so was for a video. But I had Doug Lane on, and videos, particularly videos that I have to edit on my laptop, they can end up taking many, many, many hours to render and upload. So I have to make them short, shortish. So the one with Doug, I played 20 minutes of it. And as you'll hear, it comes to a hard stop because I had another call scheduled at the top of the next hour. But the interview that I recorded with Doug, you know, the conversation we recorded was longer than 20 minutes. So I'm going to play you a longer cut of that conversation. There is some overlap with the video. So if you've seen the video, you're going to recognize parts of this. And the whole conversation isn't here because in parts of the conversation, we were talking about things that I imagine Doug didn't really want to share with any audience. And I know when I say it like that, I'm sparking your curiosity. Really, it's nothing juicy, nothing salacious, nothing personal about anybody you know. Just stuff that I imagine he didn't want shared. So again, what you're about to hear is a video call. I could see Doug, he could see me. And the first thing that I point out to him is that I had a pimple on my forehead. So that's what I'm referencing at the very beginning of this conversation.
If I can
look at this, I'm 51 years old.
Nice. And you have
a pimple. If you told my 18-year-old self that at 51 I'd still be getting zits, I might have ended it.
Now, you know what? Look, it's the least of your problems and mine. A zit is good. It means you're still got pores that are operating, you know, or not quite, but you know, you're still a human being.
Yep. I shot a video in a professional studio on Tuesday, and I was in.
You know what? I'm going to shut the door so the toilet isn't in the shot.
Okay. But on Tuesday, I was in full on-camera makeup.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'll send that picture.
Hold on, 1 second.
Yeah.
This isn't live, is it?
No, no.
This isn't live, is it?
It is not live. We are recording it.
Okay, good, good, good.
So I've never dipped a toe into the YouTube live stream thing.
Okay, and do you edit the video a little bit?
Yeah, we're not into the video. We're just talking.
Okay, good, good.
Okay, so let's see. I'm going to send you a picture of me in my full, like, on-camera makeup.
Okay.
It took, like, 20 minutes to apply. I was shocked.
I'm going to, I think I'm going to maybe dye my beard, like, shave it down and then dye it.
I've been thinking about it. I actually bought some beard coloring stuff, and I just never have used it.
Dye my beard. Going to get Botox and liposuction, and then I'm going to upload my consciousness into a better body.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks.
In the meantime, I recommend weightlifting.
Weightlifting, yeah. Does it tighten? It tightens you up, weightlifting.
Yeah. And, you know, it just makes your chest and shoulders look bigger compared to your head. Bit of an optical illusion. You can carry more fat. It sits better.
Nice.
My filing system on my PC is just a mess. That's where I need the AI help. AI, organize my files.
Yeah, I got to do something because I'm on camera a lot these days and I'm really noticing what's become of me.
I saw you on, I think it was Sky News.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I've done that twice now. You know, Ashley Frawley, who's this nearly 30-year-old academic Canadian who lives in Greece and then in, I think she's in London now, is a favorite of the Sky News. And, you know, even they started a pilot where she was involved in a pilot. I think it was on, it might have been on the BBC and not Sky News, but she's quite beautiful. She's super smart, and she listened to the podcast and then was a guest a few times and now is a reader at Zero Books. And when the producer at Sky News asked her who she suggested might be another person to become, like, on their list of we'll contact them in the morning and have them on in the afternoon types, she recommended me. And so I've done it twice. I had not even... the way I found out that Trump had suggested that we'd like to buy Greenland was producer asked me if I wanted to talk about it. So I spent like a couple hours taking notes and thinking about what I was going to say when I got on. And I don't know how well I did, but there it was.
Well, that's the segment that I saw.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was funny. You were in your kitchen, right?
Yeah.
I've stood in that kitchen. I recognize that wall.
Yeah. Did I come off like I belonged on the news or?
The background was a little incongruous, I guess, you know, for TV. But hey, check your email. I just sent you the picture of me in full full makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, I'm on a shitty webcam right now, so you can't see all the details, but when I'm on a soundstage with professional lighting and high definition cameras, every little blemish and blotch and, you know, discoloration and whatnot just leaps forward. So
yeah, yeah.
You got to wear that.
No, I mean, you look good in the picture. You don't look terrible now. I mean, you pointed out the pimple, but I wouldn't have noticed it.
Good.
So now, explain to me what this is for. Is it just for YouTube or are you doing something else as well that you're going to be, because you're talking about being on a stage and high definition and all of that.
See my lovely t-shirt here?
Yeah.
You know what that is, right?
No, tell me.
Okay. I weekly comic strip for a political.
Oh, right. I know. I do remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
It's called Geb. The website is geb.io. So John Michael Greer, the Archdruid, published something a couple weeks back about how the media now is pushing the notion of eco-fascism. Basically, if you complain that celebrity you know, ecological activists fly around in private jets and have enormous carbon footprints themselves while they scold everybody else, you know, for their profligacy. Mm-hmm. The way to discredit that now is you can say, well, look, we've had these mass shooters who are obviously these right-wing wackos, and they have environmental platforms in their, you know, their manifestos. So eco-fascism is on the rise, and if you don't like the way that, you know, celebrities and high-profile, powerful figures burn through carbon, you must be some kind of right-wing, crazy eco-fascist who's about to go on a shooting spree. And that's been, that's already an active narrative on certain aspects of the left-wing blogosphere, and John Michael Greer's prediction is that it's going to go mainstream. You're going to be seeing mainstream pundits trotting out this line. And folks,
well, you know, my problem with that is not so much the idea that the people are going to be using the term eco-fascism against people, but who gives a fuck about the celebrities traveling around on jets? Do you think that's any significant part of the carbon footprint that's causing damage to the earth?
Well, it's not. Celebrities flying around on jets is not so offensive until you pair it with them having these, you know, high profile environmental summits where they, you know, they say, oh, it's so terrible, you know, but they wouldn't dream of living like they want everybody else to live.
Well, how are you, first of all, I don't know how they want other people to live, but how on earth are you supposed to organize any kind of massive change without using the tools and technology that we already have? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Use the technology that we're using right now.
This actually ticks me off because it's so dumb. It's so ridiculous to complain about leaders, whether they're celebrities or politicians, using jets to go places to communicate, as you know, for their hypocrisy. I mean, it's like the same thing as saying, oh, you shouldn't have a YouTube channel if you're against capitalism because you're using the tools of capitalism to do it. Well, I mean, you know, any sensible way forward is not going to just toss aside everything that's been built up, you know, by society to get to something new. So, you know,
there was recently a high profile environmental summit on the island of Sicily. Mm-hmm. There were 300 high profile guests who were invited, and they flew in on 119 private jets. Mm-hmm. So that's three people per jet that they brought in.
Well, out of private jets,
Lamborghinis on site, just in case any of the, you know, the guests wanted to take a little tour of the island. And, you know, I've flown first class one time in my life. It's pretty cushy. It's pretty nice. Mm-hmm. These guys, they can't fly first class. You know, to them, that would be the same as hitchhiking. They got to have a private jet, you know, and be attended by an army, a coterie of attendants.
So who are these people, and why, and what was their plan? That's the main thing. I mean, the jets, I think, are, if they're a symbol of something else, I get it. But, you know, and yeah, the inequality between the rich and the poor is pretty disgusting. But I don't know.
It's not just disgusting. The rich are telling the poor that the poor need to downsize their carbon footprints, while the rich have no intention of doing likewise. You know, to them, they wouldn't even dream of coming down to, say, a middle class level.
Yeah, but, you know, okay.
How is that not offensive?
It's offensive, but it's not. The hypocrisy is offensive. The stratification of society is obviously bad, but it's not. If they went down to a middle class level, the problem of the environmental problems that we have would remain. You know, it's not actually trying. It's diverting from the question. Because the question is not about, you know, a few rich people and their private jets. That's not what's causing.
But suppose a rich person has a, you know, a motorcade. They're riding in maybe a Hummer or a stretch limo or something, and there's one in front and one behind. And they learn that you, Douglas Lane, take the bus, and they scold you for not walking. Why are you wasting carbon? Why are you polluting the atmosphere by taking the bus when you could walk?
I would be shocked that they noticed me first. Yeah. And secondly, if I'm in a position where they're talking to me directly, that's probably going to be great for my career.
Yes, so, it would be. But what if you're just a member of the class of people that they're talking to?
Oh, okay. So what you're really saying, but see, now we're talking about real policies. You know, this is going to come off wrong, but my understanding is that someone tried to talk to John Michael Greer, about me on a podcast a while back.
I got you know who?
A YouTube channel. Greg did. I forget his last name. But he has a small YouTube channel that sort of combines left-wing politics with an interest in the occult. So he's...
Oh, interesting. What's the title?
I'll look it up and send it to you later. But okay. but the point was, when John Michael Greer heard, oh, Doug Lane, he's a Marxist, you might be interested in him, John Michael Greer was like, ah, a Marxist? Oh, they're the worst. I can't even abide them. They're the absolute worst. He's the same way about druids. So that's all I'll say about that, you know.
I spent the last couple of days with him, and you know, we're friends.
Right.
We got drunk together, but we also had some
nice guy
arguments.
Yeah, right. But I feel like that's a really good, honest response to someone saying, hey, I like this guy, Doug Lane, he's a Marxist. I think he should say, yeah, no, he's a scumbag. That should be his response to me.
Said scumbag. That doesn't sound in character for him. But
I know, but, well, no, he didn't say it was a scumbag. But he said something like, oh, I can't abide them or something. But that's correct. That should be his line. That should be like, no, I have no time for Marxists. That should not.
So you respect that? Just categorical dismissal.
Categorical dismissal of me, because it's reciprocal. So you know, I can you know.
What category is he in that you categorically dismiss?
The mystic. You know the druid. He's a druid, for Christ's sake.
He's an arch druid, former.
Yeah, right. I mean. The religious
eco-sophia toward ecological spirituality.
Yeah, the religious response to the ecological crisis, the deification of nature, the romantic impulse, all of that I reject. I just reject it all. So I mean, I can appreciate it aesthetically and such, but I don't. And I think that this hyper focus on elites is kind of part of the issue. We can, you know, there'll be no problem with the elites once we organize for the revolution.
Hey, that's a good starting point. So,
okay.
So you said something about after the revolution. Okay, that's where we're going to start. So this is the video starting now.
All right.
Hey, Yang Gang, KMO here with another Out of My Head video. And today I am joined by Douglas Lane, who's a filthy Marxist. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, and you said that I was sharing a complaint that wealthy people fly around in private jets and private yachts to gather in luxurious resorts to talk about how the rest of us need to use less carbon. And you said elites are not the problem. And in fact, after the revolution, the elites won't even be a thing.
Yeah, well, I don't believe that the elites aren't any kind of problem. But I do think that the hyper-focus on elites as elites leads people astray. We should think about the total system and how we've set it up, that, you know, what are the conditions that create these elites, rather than just trying to address our demands and concerns to the elites and asking them to not act like elites, but still be elites, is, you know, at the very best, what you'll have are kings that ride the bus or something. You know, you're not going to really have a change in your own conditions that way. So
I'd be happy to see some kings on the bus. I mean, I know a lot of people are really down on this Greta Thunberg, is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she just took a yacht, not a yacht, she took a sailing vessel, you know, from Europe or from Scandinavia to New York City to attend a meeting at the UN because she didn't want to fly and, you know, add more carbon to the atmosphere. And, you know, flying is disproportionate in the damage that it does.
So, yeah, what are the stats on that? And
I don't have them at the ready.
Yeah, I'm gonna go to London in October. I fly about once a year, and I don't.
That's about how much I fly.
I don't generally feel particularly guilty about it.
So I have this YouTube channel which has been, you know, simmering in obscurity for years now, and suddenly I discovered that if I put the name Andrew Yang in a video title or description, more people watch it. And with this discovery, I have decided that you know, I was already doing daily YouTube uploads this year as part of my New Year's resolution. Now I'm doing daily Andrew Yang themed, you know, daily uploads.
Yeah.
And I've just been asking all the people that I regularly talk to about Andrew Yang and universal basic income. And to a person, they have been against universal basic income. And all but one of them have been generally negative on Andrew Yang. And here we go again, rolling the dice. Doug, what's your opinion of Andrew Yang and the idea of universal basic income?
Well, I'm going to try to be a little different than the other guests. I'm obviously not going to be a straight up advocate of universal basic income. I think
is that obvious?
Before. Well, because as someone who's a dirty Marxist, I don't believe that the redistribution of the income is going to work. Kimo, I have to do something about my cat. She's scratching at the door and she will distract me the entire time. Hold on. I'm really sorry. 1 second.
I'm already editing.
Okay. So why am I not going to be for universal basic income?
Yes.
Well, there's two reasons. One is that UBI might well, and it was originally sort of intended when Milton Friedman and others devised the plan to undermine other forms of the social safety net. Mm-hmm. Other parts of
with Andrew Yang's proposal, you have a choice. You can keep the assistance you're already getting, or you can take the $1,000 a month, but not both.
Right. Well, I understand that the proposal is different, but what would come out of it might not be exactly what Yang proposes, right? There's a process.
Oh, I'm sure it wouldn't be, but go ahead. What are the pitfalls you see? Because I've already done one video today about the pitfalls. I haven't posted it yet, but it's going
well,
on.
that's the major pitfall is that it would undermine the redistribution that's based on need, and that it would end up the second thing is that the major dream of UBI is that you would really liberate the working class from having the necessity to work.
Yeah, that's the background. Wouldn't do that.
It certainly wouldn't do that.
It's not intended to. It's just
right.
To relieve the economic pressure that people are feeling right now.
Yeah, and I think it could, in the short term, for some people, relieve some economic pressure. Certainly, I know everyone I know would love to get $1,000 right now, an extra $1,000. An extra $12,000.
Some people I know who wouldn't care. It would make no difference in their lifestyle. But other people, yes, it would. You know, it would add it would increase their lifestyle or their income by a third.
But even people who wouldn't really care. If you said to them, "Would you like $1,000?" They would probably, if there were no strings attached, take it.
Of course.
The same way you and I might take $10 or $5 or whatever.
Right? I absolutely would take $5.
Exactly. So I mean. Yeah, I mean, obviously, people would love to get some extra cash. It's not a bad, it wouldn't be a terrible thing. I don't think it would cripple the economy or anything. I don't think it's completely unrealistic. I just don't think it would accomplish what it's wanting to accomplish. And I think what I like about Yang and the fact that Yang is so popular, I mean, he's not a leading candidate. He's not likely to get the nomination, but he came seemingly from nowhere. And is, I think, like Tulsi Gabbard just got kicked out of the debate process, but he...
Yeah, she didn't qualify for the the upcoming debate.
But Yang does still qualify, right?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. So that's really interesting because Tulsi Gabbard has much more of a political track record than Yang. Yep. But Yang is talking about something that is a serious concern. And that's the impact that automation and digital technologies are having on our lives.
That's why I like him.
Yeah, that's what's important about him. What his actual prescription is probably less important than this fact here. And what I would just say is that before Andrew Yang, there was another guy who understood the impact of technology, and his name was Karl Marx.
He's not on the ticket, though. I mean, he's not.
No, he's not on the ticket. But and his proposals, you know, would. Are a little bit more difficult to swallow, although they probably would do more to actually.
And you can't really claim that Marx could anticipate the fourth industrial revolution. Did you listen to or read that article?
Why couldn't I claim that? I'll claim it. I'm going to claim he anticipated. I don't know if he would call it the fourth industrial revolution, but
he anticipated artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and biotechnology.
Yeah, I don't know if he anticipated the specific forms that it would take, but he anticipated getting to a place technologically where we would have something like called a general intelligence, a communal intelligence, mm-hmm. That where our technological understanding would create conditions where there would have to be social change, or not that there would have to be, but there was a potential for massive social change, and what that potential would be based on would be the free exchange. Not the exchange based on market principles, but the free exchange of understanding and intelligence and access to technology amongst people, amongst the working class to start with. And then as the working class went away, basically, amongst the free people and emancipated people. So I think Marx's idea of general intelligence as the new form of the commons is in line with what people will talk about when they talk about the fourth and revolution, the fourth industrial revolution.
So Andrew Yang says that oil, or that technology, and when he says technology, that's just a shorthand for information technology, machine learning, artificial intelligence, automation, that is the oil of the 21st century. And that, you know, the one state that has instituted anything like a basic income is Alaska. A deep red state, but they have taken a portion of their oil revenues and said, we're going to give it to everybody. Every Alaskan gets a piece of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Republicans, Alaskan deep red state Republicans love it. So what would be your response to Andrew Yang's claim that, look, this is something that has broad, broad appeal, or it will once people understand the effects that it will have in their lives?
Oh, I don't think he's wrong that this has broad appeal.
In a democracy, doesn't broad appeal carry some weight?
It does, absolutely. I would say that he's pointing to a real issue. But I think we should talk about the issue of how automation is displacing workers.
Please.
And as well as the question of how we redistribute wealth. I mean, okay, so the comparison being made here is between oil, which is a property, and the production of oil is and the revenue from that is sort of a state property in Alaska, right? The state is taking a part of that. And
now, that's an oversimplification, because really the Alaskan Fund is not a portion of oil revenue, but it's an investment fund that was set up with revenue from oil. But, you know, the amount of money
revenue.
What's that?
Taxed revenue from oil companies, or
no? And when the fund was set up, mm-hmm. the Alaskan government, yes, they did take some oil profits, and they just bought a portfolio of stocks, bonds, whatever. You know, there's an investment portfolio that was initially purchased with oil money, but the dividend that people get from year to year is not dependent on the, you know, the profits that the oil companies make. It is dependent on how that investment portfolio is doing.
Right. But the original, okay, so that's interesting. So really it's not quite.
It's not a tax on oil companies.
Right, right. It's not a tax on oil companies, and it's not a redistribution of the oil companies' profits. The original investment portfolio, which came from oil revenue, was that coming from a state-owned oil company?
That I don't know. I'm what I'm telling you, I have not researched recently. It's just from my general store of knowledge.
So, all right. So, I mean, right there, what you're talking about is actually just something that any state that happened to have a big lump of money that they wanted to put into the stock market or some other investment scheme, some other portfolio, could do, right? I mean, the fact that Alaska is an oil-rich state with a small population is what gave them the, you know, this ability to invest oil revenue into a portfolio that could be redistributed in a way that had a real impact.
Yes, it was a fairly easy thing to do. It didn't, But the thing is, it happened in Alaska. It didn't happen in Vermont. It didn't happen in Massachusetts or California or Washington State.
It would have happened in Vermont or California if they had had a small population and huge oil revenues, and they wanted to bring people to bad conditions to work for, you know, an industry that was very profitable but grueling. I mean, it's not easy for freaking Alaska.
A basic premise of Andrew Yang's argument is that machine learning and information technology are in the process of generating enormous amounts of wealth. And if we don't take proactive steps, that wealth is going to accumulate in a very small portion of the population, thus increasing the already gross disparity between rich and poor in this society. And this is something that needs to be addressed proactively before it gets, you know, even more grossly disproportionate than it already is.
I don't think Andrew Yang's wrong about digital technology generating a huge amount of wealth. But, you know, I think we have to, I really think Marx is very helpful here, because Marx distinguishes between actual wealth, sensuous stuff, buildings, food stuff, commodities that we use,
armaments,
and the value that they hold, which we measure in money. Right. And the money is a measure of the labor time invested in production, whereas the useful stuff is just useful stuff. That's real wealth, right? And the strange thing about capitalist production is that the faster you produce stuff, the less value it has, because the less labor time has gone into it. So digital technologies give us the capacity to increase production and the time we spend producing things. I mean, and decrease the time we spend producing things, right? So digital technology sets up conditions where for some industries there's massive profits, but overall there's less and less need for people working, which means also that there's less and less money being produced overall in the economy. The economy goes into crisis. This is one of the reasons why we had the economic crisis of 2008, was because of a declining rate of profit. It got expressed through the financial system. It got expressed through mortgages. But the underlying condition was this declining rate of profit. So the difficulty here is that the digital technologies are going to create wealth, but they very well could also create economic crisis. Not only unemployment, but bankruptcies, recessions. These things will come along with the expansion of the power of the speed up of production through digital technology. This is why Marx thinks that the potential to overcome the kind of relationships that set up capitalist production will arise as our technology gets more and more effective and powerful, is because there's this contradiction between the economic value that's produced in production and the real wealth. So we can have a society filled with real wealth. And
I can tell you that 90% of the Yang Gang members watching this, their eyes have glazed over. They are getting angry.
Well, that's their problem, because look, they're these people. That's shocking to me, because these are people who love the technocratic Yang with his technical fix. Well, I'm talking about something very technical, which is the way the economy works. If they can't follow along, then they need to, you know, drink some coffee and pay attention. This isn't on me for them to try to entertain them. This is on them to understand what their guy Yang is talking about and the real problems that they're facing.
I've been accused of being a crypto Bernie bro who's claiming to be a Yang supporter, but really I'm bringing on all these people who don't like universal basic income, and I'm a villain, you know.
Okay.
Villain for bringing on people like you and amplifying your voice.
Well, look, I'm not saying that Bernie Sanders is, I'm not advocating Bernie Sanders in this conversation. I mean, I happen to.
You called him a left gatekeeper in the previous electoral cycle.
Yeah, I did. And I don't.
And explain this time, what that means. I don't think a lot of people who are watching this are familiar with that phrase. What's a left gatekeeper?
Well, okay. I don't think he's consciously a left gatekeeper, but what it means is someone who will present a reformist position as if it's a revolutionary one. That's how I'm thinking of it now. Anyway, I don't know what I said before, but there was a need for dramatic change, especially again after the economic crisis of 2008. it was becoming obvious that there was something fundamentally wrong in our system. And by being the furthest to the left candidate with a set of policies that really were a compromise in the 30s and 40s, by, you know, bringing back FDR and the New Deal as the new most radical position out there, he was a left gatekeeper. He was lowering the horizon of people's expectations. But that wasn't really his action. He was more of a symptom of that horizon already being lowered. I mean, this is the limit of the left's vision today, is to return to the New Deal or to Lyndon Johnson's Great Society or something, which, again, like, I'm not against it. Like, I'm not against UBI in the short term because, yeah, some people would benefit. And I'm not against Medicare for All or those kinds of schemes to redistribute the wealth either, because people would benefit in the short term. But I'm just saying, if you want to get to the fundamental problem, you're going to have to think more deeply. And I think Yang, by addressing industrialization and automation, rather than just talking about billionaires and bankers, is getting to something more fundamental than Sanders is.
All right.
So I will.
So there, Yang. I brought on a Marxist who said something nice about Andrew Yang.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. As far as I can see, there's really three positions represented by the umpteen Democratic candidates. One is neoliberal business as usual. You know, that's Joe Biden, basically. Mm-hmm. The other is a hard shift to the left to a sort of, you know, New Deal, sort of expand government programs, expand the power of government institutions, you know, invest a lot of public money in things like, you know, clean energy and a jobs guarantee, that sort of thing, Medicare for All. And then Andrew Yang's position, to me, I have to admit, is a pretty libertarian position. I mean, his one of his catchphrases is human-centered capitalism, and he makes no bones about the fact that he is a capitalist, mm-hmm. advocates capitalism. He thinks that capitalism creates wealth, and I think you would agree that capitalism creates, you know,
absolutely wealth.
No?
Tremendous yeah. amounts of wealth.
So mm-hmm. those are the three positions on offer, and then there's Donald Trump. So of those four, you know, four more years of Donald Trump, back to the, you know, business as usual, neoliberal Democrat position, a hard shift to the left, or a modification to make human-centered capitalism, you know, to create human-centered capitalism as opposed to just vicious, you know, social Darwin capitalism. Of those four, what's your preference? Because those are what's on offer. No, there are no Marxists. No Marxists will be on the
market. I understand. You don't have to remind me there are no Marxist candidates. And if there were,
what's your preference?
Yeah. Okay. Well, my knee-jerk preference is for the hard left, you know, that Sanders. I mean, just, you know, like, if you ask me who I'm likely to vote for, I'm likely to vote for Bernie Sanders, despite the fact that I said nice things about Yang.
How about Elizabeth Warren?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, probably. I mean, I like her spirit and everything. I like how she gives it to the bankers, but I do feel like that whole focus on the billionaire class and the whole focus on the, like, Main Street versus Wall Street, that kind of talk is not entirely wrong, but it also it misleads people, because the truth is, in our system today, if Wall Street falls apart, so does Main Street. We don't have a system where we can live without the financial sector. We don't have a system where we can live without capitalist production, and that means we don't have a system where we can live without people trying to maximize profits. That is what sets up our society today. And to act as though you can demand that capitalists think about other things than maximizing profits and not be outcompeted, I think is a mistake. And I think it's misguided. But having said that, the spirit of Warren, and especially even more so Sanders, and Sanders' support for working class struggles, the way he's been involved in strikes. I mean, he promotes the struggles of striking workers. To me, is more promising than Yang's technocratic pro-capitalist libertarian approach, which is more top-down. But I don't think that simply saying, I like workers and here, let's support this strike, is going to get us to the kind of solutions that we need. So the real truth is that if I'm going to just be completely principled, I wouldn't get involved in this upcoming election. It's not where the change is going to have to come from.
You're going to write in Karl Marx?
Huh?
Are you going to write in Karl Marx?
I'll write in Karl Marx. No, I don't know. I'll probably vote for a fish again.
Okay. Last question, because I got to go. But okay. One of Andrew Yang's catchphrases, and I know I'm going to get this in the comments, is that what he's proposing by giving money to everybody is a trickle-up economy as opposed to being a top-down economy where a Sanders or Warren-style, you know, expansion of the power of the federal government to shape the economy is top-down. And you've described them in the reverse.
What I described in reverse was the fact that in order for Sanders to get political power in order to actually enact his agenda in the Congress and to succeed, he will have to build a political movement based on grassroots support. And Yang can rely on I'm not sure what Yang says about how he'll accomplish his goals and who his constituency is. But Sanders has made it clear that he's representing the working people and their struggle. And that's why I feel like the Sanders campaign is more of a grassroots campaign, even though what they're trying to do is hold on to use the power of the government to accomplish their mission.
So who is Yang's constituency?
Normal people. I don't know who those people are.
Yep.
I've never met a normal person in my life.
Well, here's what I think he means
working
by that.
People, the current, I know who they are. I know what a worker is because worker goes to work for a wage. A normal person, what does that mean? They have a picket fence and two dogs?
Here's the answer.
Yeah.
So the current economy is skill biased. People who have skills which are economically relevant are very well rewarded. But lots of people who in the 20th century could do low-skill work at decent, you know, remuneration, they're just not needed. So normal people are the people who don't go to MIT, who don't work for Apple, who don't work for Microsoft or Facebook, you know, who don't have a STEM degree or really the mental ability to get one. Realistically speaking, I don't have that skill set. You know, we are the normal people. People who still need to make a living, even though the current economy doesn't value what we have to contribute.
Well,
if you're just going to advocate workers, 20% of the workers are doing great. They're doing great. It's a great time, you know, to be really good at programming, to be really good at technical stuff, you know, to be an electrical engineer or a chemical engineer. It's a great, great time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you just want to go to work and do a job that doesn't take an advanced degree to do and come home and vacations and have Medicare or medical, you know, care, it's a bad time and it's getting worse.
Are 20% of workers getting six-figure salaries in the digital sector?
The STEM field is more like 6 to 8%.
Okay.
But so, you know, the people who have what?
And of those, how many are workers?
Jobs, they're doing pretty well too, even though they don't.
How many of those are wage workers, not salary managers?
I'm talking about
workers here, not just anyone who has a job.
To conflate wage earners and salary earners with management. I mean, most. Oh, I got to
okay,
go.
Salary.
I gotta go.
All right. Well, look. The point. We should come back and debate this again. But I'll just
stop.
All right. All right.
Everybody, this is Doug Lane. He has a YouTube channel which is way bigger than mine. It's zero books.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. So that was a conversation with Doug Lane. Of course, you recognize Doug's voice. He's been on this podcast, I couldn't say how many times, a great many. In part of the conversation, we were talking about the Alaska Fund. Basically, the investment fund that was purchased with oil money that pays out, depending on how the investment portfolio did over any given period of time, it pays out some money to everybody who lives in Alaska. And Doug kept asking me, you know, where did the initial money come from? And I said I didn't know. you know, that I hadn't researched this in preparation for the conversation. I was just drawing on my general storehouse of knowledge. And, you know, your general storehouse of knowledge doesn't have footnotes. It doesn't have links to Wikipedia entries. But rather than read to you from the Wikipedia entry, what I'm going to share instead is something that was sent to me directly. It was posted as a comment to the video. And David writes, "I like Yang's ideas generally, even though I'm deeply ambivalent about UBI. As an Alaska resident for about 12 years, I'll first say KMO's summary of it was really accurate. As for Yang using the Alaska PDF, Permanent Fund Dividend, as a way of introducing UBI to a larger crowd, I can see why he does it, but it's not really accurate. When Prudhoe Bay and the North Slope oil fields came into production in the 1970s and 1980s, well before I was here in state, Alaska had a tiny population. Immense wealth that could not be spent, it was a blue state at the time. It only became conservative after the oil boom brought in lots of oil workers and oil company executives. And it was an owner state, meaning the oil wealth, well, most subsurface mineral wealth, including most oil, belonged to the state rather than individual landowners. So when the companies were all private, BP, Exxon, etc., the state originally got a better cut. The original proposal for the permanent fund dividend was to base the share depending on longevity in the state. So a 20-year resident might get 20 shares of the oil wealth dividend, and a 1-year resident might get 1 share. This was challenged in court and struck down, unfortunately. So now we all get a yearly check, even 1-year-olds. It varies from $800 to over $1,000 each year based on what the permanent fund makes in profits. It was done well, but by comparison, Norway, which basically nationalized its oil, had a permanent fund many, many times larger, i.e., they did even better. Ironically, if the state had been red at the time, it probably wouldn't have taxed oil companies so much originally that a permanent fund could have been set up. Currently, we have the resource state problem that after a boom, we're facing a bust, partly because of declining oil production, but also because we're actually paying the oil companies several hundred million more dollars yearly in production subsidies than we take in for oil taxes. We now have conservatives arguing for radical cuts in state spending, keeping very low oil taxes and industry subsidies, and decrying socialism, while arguing for generous PFD payments from the state government each year. I think oil has probably been good for Alaska, but it's a mixed blessing. And the PFD it generated is a poor, ill-fitting analogy for UBI, in my opinion. So thanks to David for that perspective. That was helpful. And speaking of my daily YouTube videos, I did one, was it just yesterday? Maybe it was just yesterday or the day before. I think it was the day before. Anyway, I recorded a video in which I touched on the topic of intergenerational tensions and animosity here in the United States. The video is called Sympathy for the Boomers. And if you're interested, well, I would suggest you go and check it out on my YouTube channel. But it reminded me that I had written a blog post about, you know, the plight of the boomers. And I didn't remember, you know, actually where I posted it or when. So I just Googled KMO Gen X Slacker, and Google served it right up to me. It is a post from my blog at crealm.blogspot.com. This is from May 31st, 2013. So this is when I was living in Brooklyn. And this is actually going to be a cold reading. I have not gone back to reread this, and I don't know in advance that I'm still going to agree with the KMO of 2013. We'll see. But back in May of that year, I wrote, "In the wake of World War II, the United States stood intact amidst countries leveled and exhausted by conflict and was thus in a position to dictate the terms of the new international economic order. From this position of strength, the USA relieved the British of their global empire, set the US dollar as the world's reserve currency, and established a flow of imperial tribute from the global economic periphery to the new center of imperial gravity, while demurring at the prospect of actually calling ourselves an empire. Our soldiers returned home to a booming industrial economy that was hungry for workers. Jobs were plentiful, as were houses in the new suburbs for qualified GIs. The corporations feared underproduction, and the government feared discontent among veterans who might organize and agitate. And so advertisers convinced workers to define themselves and express their individuality through their purchases. Their patterns of consumption became their identity. The rights and privileges of citizens devolved into the rights and privileges of consumers. The new architects of suburbia laid out the new subdivisions without public spaces and with houses designed to direct the family's attention to the backyard rather than to the street. Fossil fuels were practically free, and the new interstate highway system and prosperous workers elevated the car that was a necessary component of suburban living to an exalted position in the pantheon of consumer goods. Jim Kunstler's age of happy motoring commenced. The children of this jubilant period, the baby boomers, were the ultimate repository of the aspirations of this triumphant culture, and their parents, the self-identified greatest generation, told their children that they were the heirs to the kingdom of heaven made manifest on earth. They could have anything, do anything, and surpass God's angels as the ultimate manifestation of his vision. The boomers' parents told them that if they played by the rules, embraced their own self-aggrandizing mythology, and worked hard, they could enjoy unprecedented educational opportunities, careers, prosperity, and abundance. And so it was, for a time. In that period in which the baby boomers' self-congratulatory narrative was taking shape, the United States was the world's biggest oil exporter. By the time I was born in 1968, domestic oil production was reaching its peak. I was a child when the second OPEC oil embargo of the 1970s created fuel shortages. TV news reports focused on the long lines and short tempers at gas stations. The embargo was short-lived, and the bonanza soon resumed. And by the time I started driving in 1984, gas still cost less than a dollar a gallon. My father continued to repeat the core tenet of the boomer belief system that every generation in America does better than their parents. Douglas Copeland published his novel, Generation X, Tales for an Accelerated Culture, in 1991, when the baby boomer belief system remained unassailable. The explanation for the fact that the boomers' children did not seem to be on track to exceed their parents in achievement and material abundance was a story of how the Gen Xers were cynical, psychologically detached, and more interested in sabotaging the American dream with their hip irony than in joining the workforce and embracing their American birthright. The problem had nothing to do with the decline of an economy based on manufacturing or with the rise of the new financialized economic order that didn't need nearly as many workers as before. The problem was clearly with the young people, who could have lived even larger than their baby boomer parents if only they would shrug off their unjustified malaise and get with the program. According to this narrative, the Gen Xers' obscure media obsessions and their rejection of the supposedly bourgeois values of their parents was just a smokescreen for laziness. Richard Linklater's 1991 film, Slacker, sealed the deal and indelibly affixed the suffix slacker to my generation. Just speak the words Gen X slacker aloud. Notice how easily they roll off the tongue. As easy as it is to say, the Gen X slacker meme slotted into the baby boomers' worldview just as effortlessly as it spilled out of their mouths. The greatest generation propelled the USA on its path to global dominance with their hard work and belt-tightening at home and with their courage and self-sacrifice in the theaters of war. Or so goes their self-serving narrative. Lewis Menard, writing about Timothy Leary for The New Yorker, offers a different take. Quote, Leary belonged to what we reverently refer to as the greatest generation, that cohort of Americans who eluded most of the deprivations of the Depression, grew fat in the affluence of the post-war years, and then preached hedonism and truancy to the baby boom generation, which has taken the blame ever since. Great ones, we salute you. Close quote. The baby boomers enjoyed an unprecedented starting position, and they did their part to fulfill the glorious destiny that their parents' heroism made possible. Then along came Generation X, and in a self-indulgent fit of unjustified cynicism, the slackers sabotaged the whole glorious enterprise with their obstinate refusal to get with the program. The scapegoating of Generation X is a narrative you probably haven't heard repeated any time recently, but if you are a baby boomer, you surely did not encounter the phrase Gen X slacker for the first time here in this blog. You may not have heard it or read it, much less said it, since the fall of 2008, but reading it now surely activates long-dormant mental circuits, as when hearing an advertising jingle from yesteryear. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is, fast, fast, fast. Now that the grand-scale malfeasance of a financialized economy is a fait accompli, and the speculative bubbles that seduced homeowners into liquidating the accumulated equity in their homes have affected a mass transfer of wealth to the rentier class, and the boomers feel the walls of the shrinking middle class closing in on them, the Gen X slacker meme no longer fits the current narrative. Consequently, it has fallen into disuse. The boomers may have conveniently forgotten how regularly they once used that detestable phrase, or how fully they embraced it as a label that identified something real. But for most of my 20s and well into my 30s, the mainstream narrative of the echo chamber corporate media and the dinner table conversations that it informed treated the concept of the Gen X slacker as if it had real explanatory and predictive power. The boomers may have forgotten their behavior from this period, but we Gen X slackers remember. Now that the glorious destiny of the baby boomers lies in ruins and the boomers have eclipsed depressed teenagers and the elderly as the group most likely to commit suicide, it is tempting, though certainly not helpful or praiseworthy, to enjoy a moment of schadenfreude as the boomers wallow in their incomprehension, disbelief, and despair. If you were a member of Generation X, or some later generation, and grew up in the confining shadows of the most annoyingly smug, self-important, pampered, and flattered demographic phenomenon in living memory, a group that has insisted that they did everything right, and now that things are visibly falling apart, that it must be because young people are too lazy or self-absorbed to take on the roles of responsible working adults, no, the boomers don't see the irony, and they're accusing anyone of putting selfish obsessions above the good of one's community, nation, or civilization. Well, if you want to take a moment to enjoy their wailing and gnashing of teeth, go ahead. We have work to do, but if you don't think that you have taken ample time to gloat, snort, and savor their lamentation, then a nagging sense of a missed opportunity might distract you from the task ahead. The task will require your full attention and focus, so if you want to just pause here and take satisfaction in the boomer's moment of manifest failure and ignominy, that's okay. I won't even say I'll wait, because I cannot claim that I've yet had my fill and that I'm over it. I will be gloating right along with you for as long as you care to linger in this moment of anti-bodhisattvahood. Insert timeless moment for gloating. Okay. Done? Good. Me too. Now, let's build up a little compassion before we continue, because we are going to be a lot more useful to our communities and to our civilization if we are working in a spirit of compassion and empathy than if we move forward with a gale force ideological wind filling our egoic sails with righteous indignation. What's more, forgiving the baby boomers and welcoming them into the ranks of conscious revolutionaries will be good practice for forgiving and learning to work with the 1%. We cannot build lasting prosperity, effect ecological restoration, and navigate the challenges of increasingly disruptive technological development while simultaneously fighting a war against our oligarchs. I certainly don't want to leave a world to my children that is the product of a global revolution in consciousness, born of savagery and vengeance. As annoyed as you may have felt at the boomers, who thought that their own choices and actions created the unprecedented prosperity that they enjoyed from birth, right up to the moment when they had the rug pulled out from under them at the end of their careers, you probably never wanted to parade them through the streets, march them up onto a platform, and end their lives in a public spectacle of brutal revenge entertainment. But if you don't occasionally thirst for the blood of the 1%, the people who robbed the rest of us with debt, presided over the dismantling of the industrial economy, confiscated that portion of the imperial tribute gravy train that used to go to the middle class, and used the occasion of global crisis to justify a massive transfer of wealth to their own strata, and simply assumed that the rest of us would just reconcile ourselves to the new normal and continue to feed on the false hope of winning the lottery or somehow becoming famous, then you are a more spiritually advanced being than I am, and I salute you. We will need more like you if we are going to make it through the coming transition with our souls intact. For the time being, just know that the boomers were, for the most part, either doing what their parents told them was the right thing to do, or trying to correct the moral and intellectual failings of their parents, and mostly failing themselves, but in new and spectacularly creative ways. If we can learn from the mistakes of previous generations, the boomers have much to teach us. So, do I still agree with all that? Well, maybe not with the the attitude in which it is written, but certainly the message, I think, is still worth paying attention to. And I know that, you know, My audience, the Sea Realm Vault audience, who actually pays to listen to this, is disproportionately weighted with baby boomers. Baby boomers, do you remember the Gen X slacker meme? I can assure you, Generation X remembers. Fortunately, there aren't that many of us, and I can't speak to the attitude of millennials. My recent adventures in YouTube and trying to attract a larger viewing audience by putting Andrew Yang's name in the video, I've learned that very few millennials really connect with what I have to say. Or perhaps it's how I say it. And it's kind of strange because I have almost no contact, you know, real-life contact with millennials. Living in southern Vermont, young people tend to flee, and those that stay are of a social class, shall we say, that I don't enjoy interacting with. My kids are both of the generation that follows the millennials, as is Colin over at the TV station with whom I do my Friday videos. But people in their late 20s and early 30s, I almost never have any face-to-face interaction with them. And the behaviors which have been normalized by social media, really odious behaviors, you know, I have said things online that I hope I wouldn't say, you know, in person. And if I did say them in person, you know, face to face with somebody, I would hope that I would either be enraged by some special circumstance or possibly drunk. But the sort of things that people type on Twitter or Facebook on a Monday morning when they are fully sober are the sorts of things that would cause me to blush if I, you know, if somebody played a recording of me speaking them aloud when I was intoxicated. I know that the imperatives and the reinforcements of social media have lured me into behaviors that, you know, I regret now. And they were overcoming my previous conditioning, not laying down my initial conditioning, as social media has done for the millennials. So as much as I remember resenting the attitude of the boomers, I don't resent the attitude of the millennials. I just don't connect with it. And I just find it unappealing. But as I move in, you know, from middle age into my early old age, I'm certainly going to be swimming in an environment defined by the attitudes, the desires, the prejudices of the millennials, particularly as the baby boomers die off. Because Generation X, those of us who were teens in the 80s, there just aren't that many of us. We were a small generation, a blip, not worth marketing to, really, and a generation that you could easily ignore, denigrate, or scapegoat. And once the boomers are gone, I think Gen X will be the prime target for that scapegoating. And with that, I am going to bring this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast to a close. Thank you very much for subscribing. If there's something that you would like for me to talk about, or research in order to inform the future content of this podcast, well, you know where to find me. I look forward to hearing from you. Stay well.